Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. How you doing? It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And today's episode was such a great chat. I sat down with Andy Cairns of Therapy. We'd done this during lockdown over Zoom, and it was an amazing chat. We discussed so much of the kind of the early punk stuff that he was exposed to in Belfast during the Troubles and such, going to those early gigs. I mean, the nightclub experience that Andy went to is just off the scale amazing. And that's something you're going to just be blown away by. It just sounds like the greatest club ever. When we start talking record shops, we start talking about Good Vibrations. And I won't tell you any more because it's an amazing chat and he's an absolutely top fella as well. You're going to love this episode. Before we get on with it, I just want to say thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. And a huge thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. He's having to work super hard at the moment, 76, producing his podcast, because so many of them are done remotely. And so sometimes, you know, you get little glitches on the recording side of things when using, you know, your Zooms and Skypes, and he's doing a stellar job to ensure that you still get a really nice sounding podcast. So thanks, 76. If this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then please go and explore the back catalogue, because there's about 120 or so episodes with some of your favourite musicians, producers, DJs, actors, comedians. So go and have a rummage around in the archives and see if there's anything you find that that tickles your fancy. Better still, subscribe, and then each week another episode just pops up on your listening device. And if you want even more, then I have a Patreon page, and so you can support the podcast over there, and I put a standalone episode up on there each week as well. You can find out about everything at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Let's take a breath. Okay. Right, let's get back to the episode. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Andy Cairns. Listen up. I've only got another new sponsor, Eggfried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this, they have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Eggfried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Keep me, Stew, with him. Okay, we're recording, and sitting opposite me today via the means of Zoom in lockdown is Andy Cairns. Hello.
Hello, Stu. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you, mate. Well, I really appreciate you giving up your time today and having a chat about tunes with me. But before we get on to the playlist, I just want to know how you found the last couple of months as a as a human being and as a creative?
Well, as a human being, I was actually all right until about 2 weeks ago, and that was the first time I had a bit of a wobble. I'm very lucky. I mean, I've got my wife's able to work from home. My son, he came back from uni just the minute the pandemic started to happen. So my family's here. But so it was all right. I've got a really good routine. You know, I do certain things to make sure that I've got some kind of structure because,
yeah,
I mean, we would have played dozens and dozens of shows at this point. We'd have been in the rehearsal studio. We probably would have been demoing tracks. So, you know, I just make sure I get up every day, go for a run, and make time in the evening for the family. As a creative, it's been brilliant because I've been playing more guitar than usual. It's funny, you know, as a touring musician, one of the kind of paradoxes is that you don't actually get a chance to play your instrument apart from the 2 hours you're on stage in the evening,
yeah,
or at the sound check, because we're doing so much time traveling, checking into hotels, getting to the gig, whatever. So, like, it's given me loads of time to go in and, you know, do things like say, oh, right, today I'm going to write a new riff. I'm going to look at this old song we haven't played in ages. And I'm going to look at learning somebody else's guitar part that looks a bit tricky. It might be really good to get, you know, that might teach me something new.
Yeah.
So that's good. The only thing that I found I want to try and avoid is writing the pandemic album. Because nothing will date more than the present. You know, and what, I mean, as someone that writes, I have to be careful that what I say now doesn't sound horrendously dated. If somebody, I still want, yeah, if I write a song now, I want people still to be able to listen to it in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years time, not have it down as, you know, well, that's therapy's, you know, virus album. So,
yeah,
so I mean, there's ways that we can approach it. And that's quite interesting, you know, with a lockdown, you know, without having to sort of write something like that. It's, which would be really easy to do with a band of our kind of, you know, musical,
yeah,
background. That's a bit of a challenge, but I'm enjoying it. I mean, I've talked to other people, I've talked to Michael and Neil in the band, and they're actually, I'm lucky, my son's, you know, he's grown up, he's at uni, he can pretty much fend for himself, but they've got two very young kids each, and they're having to do the whole homeschooling thing.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky I don't have to do that, so I can get up, go for a run, and then go out into my man's shed and plug in my guitar and spend 3 or 4 hours out there. They don't really, yeah, have that luxury because they're being a school teacher during the day and that, mm, in the afternoon, and then, you know, they're a storyteller in the evening.
Yeah.
So then they're also trying to squeeze in rehearsing and writing material. So yeah, I'm okay.
Okay. Well, you talked about playing riffs and stuff a moment ago. So that's a nice tenuous link to the first track. So I'm going to ask you, Andy, what you regard as the song with the greatest ever intro.
It's Another Girl, Another Planet, The Only Ones. And
what a
it's,
record.
Well, it's an amazing record, and it's like, you know, whenever I just really get into music, I mean, I discovered music when I was 6 or 7. It was the first thing I ever got passionate about, before football, before movies, before art, you know, before girls. it was music. And I'd always like punk, and I really got into punk, and guitar solos were the enemy. So, you know, I'd read about The Only Ones being this great punk band, and I sort of came into punk through Ramones and through the Buzzcocks. It was very much fast bar chords. There was no guitar solo. And, you know, whenever I first heard Another Girl, Another Planet, it could have been Dire Straits, the intro. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as a bad way, because the first Dire Straits album's incredible. Mm. But It was like, can I actually like this, or does this have to be something I listen, yeah, to in secret? Because,
yeah,
there's such a blatantly brazen guitar solo. But I went with it, and it's one of those. I've never met anyone that doesn't like that song.
And it's an incredible record.
Yeah, and it's brilliant. And, you know, I was very, very lucky. In 1994 at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, we had Pete Parrott join us on stage, and we did that song.
Oh, amazing.
And I got to meet him and hang out with him afterwards. But it's the best intro of a song because it's got everything. It starts off, it sort of creeps in, and it's got that little tight, chuggy riff. So you think,
yeah,
well, this is just going to be a kind of punk, kind of new wave stomper.
Yeah.
And then there's a guitar slide, and all of a sudden it goes stratospheric.
Yeah.
And then it comes in, it just drops into this fragile little voice telling this story of kind of existentialist love and cosmic romance. And then whenever it doesn't get any, you know, so, and then there's an even better guitar solo in the middle as well.
Yeah.
But I think as regards to the intro, it was just, it just, it keeps building and building and building, and it's not bombastic, and that's really difficult to do. Anyone could do that Wagnerian kind of bombast and, you know, build up blocks. But there's just all these little bits and pieces that drop in the sound field that make it so brilliant.
So I always ask musicians this question, Andy, and in the way that you approach writing records now, I'm talking specifically about the intro. Has that changed over the years in the way that nowadays, the way that people listen to music is far different from how they would have listened to therapy when you first broke through? Nowadays with streaming services and things like that, there's so many distractions going, you might like this, you might like this. Mm-hmm. Do you ever sort of consider the intro being something to grab them straight away and try and sort of hold their attention? Is that still in the mindset of you as a musician now, and was it then?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been important.
Sorry, that's a really loaded question there, Andy. Do you get where I'm going with it?
I mean, I know exactly what you mean. It's a bit like the way young grime artists know that the majority of people listen to their music on a mobile phone. So the opening riff has to be in the really top register so that if they're at a bus stop or they're with their mates outside, that really cuts through, and it cuts through like that. And then I suppose in our day, I mean, a good example of that from our end of things is there's two songs you can think of off the bat. One of them is arguably our best-known song called Scream Major. And it was meant to be our homage to Stiff Little Fingers and the Undertones. It was like a pop, not pop punk, I don't want to use that term, but it was like Ulster punk done by, you know, a modern-ish at the time band. And initially with Chris Sheldon on board, and he knew what we were trying to do, we said we want to write like an update of the stuff we listened to as kids. It's about growing up and being a teenager in Northern Ireland. But originally, that anyone that knows that song, the intro is really simple. It goes boom, 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 then straight in with the riff.
Yeah.
That's not how it used to go. It used to go Chris Sheldon, kind of the producer at the time, he said, "So you want this to be like a Northern Irish pop single?" And we're going, "Yeah,
yeah."
But he goes, "Teenage Kicks goes blah and blah and straight in." So
maybe
if you can get therapy's equivalent of blap and blap and get rid of the Cygnus X1 kind of, you know, like.
I want to hear the prog version of Scream Major now.
That's one version. And the other one is whenever we had a song called Nowhere, which is another well-known song of ours. It's got this little really simple guitar riff that goes na-na-na. Like, it's meant to sound like police cars. And initially, the song didn't have that. It's very similar to Another Girl, Another Planet in the chord structure. It's very kind of hot, cold, melancholy guitar progression. And at the start, it just went straight in. And we were thinking about it needs an intro, and we tried several things. And I just happened to be listened to, but it was Happenstance. I was listening to Police on My Back for The Clash. Yeah. And they've got this little guitar. It sounds like a guitar siren as well. So I just thought, why don't I try something like that? And I just went to the tonic chord of the song that was A, and I thought, if I put these two fingers here. And it's one of those things, it was so simple. I literally said, look, you're going to laugh at this. I went, no, and everyone in the room went, that's it. Yeah. But I just thought, I can't actually bring this to the room because it's so ridiculous. But it's so memorable. But that was important.
So was radio a consideration then?
I'm trying to think. The only thing about radio I remember was the language thing, and none of our singles, and we didn't deliberately do it. Scream Major Nowhere didn't have any profanities in them, but that was just the way the songs were written. I do remember when we took Trouble Gun in North America, they really, really liked the song called Knives, which is the opening track on Trouble Gun, and it drops the F-bomb several times. But they it wasn't like they were taking us around to kind of indie stations in America, and they were going, it's a bit too heavy. But a couple of the mountains in North America loved it. But they said, well, we can't play our favorite tracks called Knives, but it's got the F-bomb all over its way on M Records America. did this version where I'm going to get, and that's what they took. And they played it. And I remember being on tour in America and going, you're listening to such and such 106, and this is from Iron Therapy. And it was ridiculous. Why didn't they just release something else? But they were adamant. And there's so many profanities in that song that the whole just is, it's like a Beaker from the Muppet Show singing it.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. All right. Well, for track two, Andy, I'm going to ask you the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
It was Buzzcocks, Ever Fallen in Love with Someone You Shouldn't Have. And there'd been, I mean, I remember the first music I really remember hearing was glam rock, because we were allowed to watch from the age of about 4 or 5. I think Top of the Pops, whatever night it was, we were allowed to stay up a bit later and watch it. Because I used to always sing the songs the next day, which my mom and dad thought was hilarious. And there is a tape in the house of me singing This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us by Sparks, the four-year-old.
That's an ambitious song as well.
Which my mom still has. And I like that. But all these things that were fun. You know, my mom had the 7-inch Diamonds Are Forever by Jadat. There was lots of stuff around the house that I liked. But the first one that I emotionally connected with was 8, 9, 10, 13. I was 13 years of age, and I actually remember where I was. I was having a breakfast with my brother, about to go to school, and Radio 1 played the Buzzcocks, Ever Fallen in Love. And at that age of 13, I'd gone to secondary education. I didn't know where I was going to go in life. I was beginning to grow up a little bit, you know, hormones were kicking in. And I remember hearing that song. And I'd never heard the Buzzcocks before. There was a lad in school a year above me called John Gray, and he had Buzzcocks on the back of his school bag. And I heard it, and I thought, because John Gray was a punk, and I thought, Buzzcocks were meant to be a punk band. So I really liked this record, and I couldn't get the melody out of my head all day. And I went into school, and of course, went and tapped Ray on the shoulder and said, I thought Buzzcocks were a punk band. He goes, yeah, they are a punk band. He told me all about them. So time, I think I managed to get that record a few weeks later on, and then I started getting obsessed with the Buzzcocks. But that was, for some reason, I think it's the chord structure, the melody, and there's something about Pete Shelley's, God bless him, something about his delivery was it was so nervous and anxious, and it wasn't bombastic. And I mean, as I mentioned earlier, all the stuff I grew up listening to, like glam rock, was always on TV. I always thought, well, I can't be like that person, because that person, if you look at Elton John and Mark Bolan and David Bowie, you thought, well, those people weren't born in a semi-detached house in the state in County Antrim. Those people arrived on a spacecraft from Mars.
Obviously, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But whereas someone like Pete Shelley, and then I think a few weeks after I heard that on the radio, they were on Top of the Pops, and they were wearing what they looked like the people that kind of sat in our upper sixth common room at school. You know, there was loads of like woolly jumpers and little big shirts and bald head haircuts. And so I just thought, well, I can kind of get where that's coming from.
Yeah. So you've mentioned Top of the Pops. Did Therapy get on Top of the Pops?
Yeah, I think we were on it some like 7 times.
So I'm always really curious to know, like, for you know, I'm sure, like, you know, as you mentioned, you know, you was glad to stay up late to watch it. It was one of the most important nights of the week for me was when Top of the Pops was on, because it was the only time you got to see your pop stars.
Yeah.
And so how was it for you growing up watching that? And then I guess let's talk about the first time you went on Top of the Pops. Was it everything and more, or was it kind of, well, I'm just curious to know what it was like.
The first time we went on, it was Screamager. And we were from a hardcore punk background, and there was two schools of thought. People like myself and Michael thought, well, that's where we saw the Buzzcocks, that's where we saw the Damn. UK Subs were on Top of the Pops.
That's right.
Men were on Top of the Pops. And then there was the other people who went, well, the Clash never did Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And they were the more hardcore ones. What are you doing that for? The Clash never did it.
Yeah.
And I suppose, like, well, luckily for us, we were from the former camp, and we had no problem doing it. And I was very nervous, because it was like... it was like, you know, they bust in all the people from near wherever the place was nearby. They bust in all these young girls and guys. It was like 2 or 3 buses of youth club people. And literally, they're there when you're doing your rehearsal during the day. And there's all the pop bands on, and they're all dancing. And then we go to run through, and everyone in the audience is just looking at each other going, what's this? You know, like, he doesn't look like a pop star. Bass player might be a little bit, well, I mean, the drummer doesn't speak. Bass player's wearing like, what on earth is this meant to be? It doesn't look like, what the hell doesn't look like? I was very self-conscious about that. But a couple of stories I do remember about, and the very first Top of the Pops, I used to be a massive fan of the Skids and Big Country, and I remember going to see Big Country opening for U2 in Dublin, and I went the whole way down just to see Big Country. And afterwards, it was the only pop star I'd ever met up to this point. Stuart Adamson wasn't, he had done a set, which was brilliant, and he was out walking through the crowd. I thought, he can't walk through the crowd. You know, he's Stuart Adamson. He doesn't walk through the crowd like a mere mortal. And I remember going over nervous, and he said, that was really brilliant. And he shook my hand, says, oh, thanks very much. And I was made up because he wasn't rude. He was really polite.
Yeah.
The first time we did Top of the Pops, Big Country were on it.
Oh, really?
I was standing there, getting my guitar strap on, and there was a rap on the door, and Stuart Adamson came in and says, oh, I just want to say I really like your band. And I really wanted to say, I've actually met you before. And I was like, oh, my God. And then I remember that. So that was really, really funny. But it was...
That's fantastic.
Yeah. But it's bizarre because, you know, EastEnders used to share the canteen. So, like, you would be given a food voucher and you would go and get your food in the canteen, and there'd be the cast of EastEnders would be standing in the queue with you. And, you know, we're from Northern Ireland. We're from a little town in Northern Ireland, Larne and Ballyclare in Northern Ireland. It's like,
yeah,
we don't have any kind of that sort of calm collectedness of bands in London and stuff. Like,
yeah,
we'd be like just looking at everyone and staring at them when we were in the country. But, I mean, we did it seven times, and it got easier every time. And then by the end, it was just like, but you know, it was the very, very first time we definitely felt like we didn't belong. But we were glad we did it, and everyone kind of. It was that kind of thing where when we signed A&M Records, my mom and dad were always going, you know, you used to have a nice car, you used to live in an apartment, you had a job, and now you're driving around with long hair and, you know, you're doing this thing and the music's unlistenable. Why? And I remember saying, we've signed A&M Records, home of like Janet Jackson and the Police, and then whenever I phoned them up and said, oh, we're on Top of the Pops, I don't think my dad believed me. He went, yeah, of course you are. I went, no, we're on Top of the Pops. So they all watched it. You know, so that was the only time that I think the entire, you know, family of ours watched.
Acknowledged you'd made it.
Well, that was it, yeah. And it was almost like, well, I don't really like the song much and I don't know what it's all about, but, you know, he's on.
The Killer Tricks Future Weapons EP is out now. Seven tracks. Listen on all the major streaming platforms or find out where to buy in the show notes. It's badass, like me, the sexy robot lady. Ooh yeah, baby. Right there. That's good.
Oh, brilliant. Just to go back to Ever Falling in Love as well, what was the emotion you felt when you heard that?
I suppose the nearest I can feel was longing. And I can't remember, there was a longing in it. And I don't, you know, at that age, you don't really know what it is. You feel as if you're on the cusp of something.
Sure.
And you can't tell what it is. And I felt as if I don't know where it was. You know, I was curious about where I was going to be. There was lads that were older than me that were able to go to gigs. I wasn't able to go to gigs yet because I was 13, and they were coming in and having to go on the same bands like Stiff Little Fingers and Rudy and the Outcasts, all these punk bands, and they were able to go in. And they would get in at 16 years of age, and they'd come in with all these great war stories the next day. And also, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to be. I discovered this thing as well, always. And that was, I mean, after the Buzzcocks, I was a punk rocker then for quite a few years because that kind of got me into it. And ended up with the haircut, you know, the biker jacket and all this. But that was the first time I heard it. It was almost like, it was a sense of longing and a sense of like, of, you know, where do I belong in all those people? I honestly, no exaggeration, I remember exactly where I was and how I felt when I heard that song. It's incredible. And it's like Another Girl, Another Planet. It's, I could never tire of listening to that song.
Yeah, totally.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ellie. Okay, well, let's talk about them formative years for track three. Andy, the song reminds you of your time at school.
Mm-hmm. Is it Stranglers? Yeah. Well, the reason why I chose this was I'd started playing. I'd already played. I mean, whenever I was in primary school, I used to play the trombone. And because I played that when I went to secondary education in Ballyclare High School, I ended up being in the school orchestra. So still did that. But at this point in time, when I discovered the Buzzcocks and the Ramones and Stiff Little Fingers and Rudy and all this, I thought, I want to play an instrument. And there was a guy down the road from us. He was at school with me. And his uncle had recently died. And his uncle had been in like a covers band that played pubs and clubs in Northern Ireland. And he had left a little Jetson bass guitar and a Shalex six-string guitar to them, and none of them could play. And God bless him, his mum came up to our house one day and said, Andrew's a bit musical. Would he be interested in playing these, taking these on? So I got the bass and the guitar, and it was the bass I first liked because I really loved the Stranglers. And I loved John Jack Brunel. He looked brilliant. I liked Peter Hook. Yeah. Peter Hook and John Jack Brunel. But those records, so I got myself an older, and I used to work out all the bass lines. But the thing about the Stranglers was that they were really popular in Northern Ireland. I mean, really popular. And everybody loved them. And, you know, I got into the Buzzcocks and the Only Ones. They weren't everyone's taste, but it was like the Stranglers. I remember going to see them for the first time at the Ulster Hall in Belfast when I was, I think, 15. And there was teachers from my school there. There was the older kids from school there. You know, it was like everyone was there. And I think that's what got me totally in. That was whenever I first started playing music myself and having a sense of community. Because I would go around to other people's houses at musical instruments and they would know Stranglers bass lines or Stranglers songs.
Sure.
And, whenever I started jamming with other people, not everyone would have known the Buzzcocks, but everyone seemed to know the Stranglers. Yeah.
So, did you enjoy school?
No, I hated it. I absolutely.
Why did you hate it?
Well, I've lived in the house and stayed at the top of the town, and I went to Ballyclare High School, which is a grammar school, and it was a Protestant grammar school, and it very much fancied itself as almost like the equivalent of an English private school, they were very snobby. And they made it very, very clear from the moment I went there that the people, there was me and two other kids from our estate that went to the school, and our parents, my dad worked in a factory, this other guy's dad was a carpenter, the other one was a spark. And they made it very, very clear to us from the very start that we would be tolerated. And, you know, whenever we got to be 16, then we could bugger off and get an apprenticeship somewhere. It was very much like that. And a lot of the other kids, healthier families, and they would treat it in such a blatantly different way. And I knew there wasn't just kids from where from my estate. There was kids, you know, nearby, 10 miles away that came to school. Especially it was in a state called Rathcoole up the road, and there was a load of people from Rathcoole came, and they got the same treatment. And so I found it very difficult. I rebelled quite a lot against it. I didn't like teachers. I found elements of the school quite sectarian. Although, in its defence, some of my best, you know, through two teachers, Mr. Thompson and Mr. Hazard, I discovered an absolute love for English literature, which stayed with me to this day. And, I met a lot of really, really good friends there. I expect that I'm still friends with now. I've got a few of them I'm still friends with now, you know. I didn't like it at all. I really, really hated it. I didn't mind primary school as much, but I hated secondary education. And I stayed on, did my A-levels, and that was even worse because there was less people then stayed on for their A-levels, sure. And it became even more elitist. So, I mean, I had a friend of mine that was in a band with, you know, we discovered music together, and that was kind of the thing that we conned.
Is that what you wanted to be at school? Did you make your mind up that a musician was something that, I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, that pop stars come like Bowie and that come from outer space. You know, did it feel like, you know, somebody coming from an estate in Northern Ireland could, you know, did it feel attainable that you could become, you know, a successful musician?
No, I didn't. I used to play a lot in little bands that we had, but I'd made up my mind by the time I was 17, because the big thing was Paul Weller famously was on Top of the Pops when he was 18. And then among all our friends, there was a thing that if you haven't made it by 18, then forget it. So I remember
was that the benchmark?
Well, that was it, because a lot of people, it's like the Stranglers. Everyone that I knew loved the Jam and respected. Yeah. And even, you know, I liked the Jam a lot and respected Paul Weller. But the thing was, he was famous when he was 18. And I remember being in sixth year and going, well, I'm doing my A-levels next year. And after doing my A-levels, I'll be 19 in September. And Paul Weller, and I've done two albums by that time, so I may as well forget about it. So I remember thinking, well, you know what? I'll always play the guitar because I love doing it, and I've got a bunch of mates. We've got mates peppered all around the town. One played the bass, one played the drums, and we could run and hang out. So I sort of thought, well, I really love English, but, you know, I'm not going to go to uni. By the looks of it, you know, I like English and art. I did them for A-level. But I was told by one of the careers advisors at school, well, why don't you get a career in journalism? Go to Rupert Stanley College or something like that. And I suppose what I had, and I put the band thing to the back of my mind, I sort of thought, well, what I'll do is I'll take a year out and then I'll look at going and doing journalism. And then things began to change once I took the year out. But, you know, certainly whenever I left school, I'd never had it in my head that I was going to make it as a, you know, as a pop star or rock star. That was never ever the point. It was always, well, I like doing this because it helps me. Playing the guitar helps me with all this frustration I have. And it was the way
to... confident?
But it didn't make me confident, but it was an escape. We're at the estate that I lived in at the top of, it was Ballyclare, which is a market town just outside Belfast. I lived at the top of state, which was back in the 70s, quite rough. But it was directly opposite Stone Quarry. So if you were nervous in any way anxious, three or four times a day, there'd be explosive blasts. But add that to the fact that you're also living in Northern Ireland in the 70s. So the explosions never stopped. You know what I mean? So the only thing I had was I used to come home from school, put my headphones on really, really loud. And then after my tea, I would just play the guitar and I had a little bass set up and a little guitar set up. And that was kind of my escape. But I always thought when I left school, I'd probably end up working in journalism or something like that. But I would always play the guitar as a hobby.
Okay. Track four, Andy. First song you remember buying from a record shop?
Sweet Blockbuster. That was when I bought that when it came out. And I remember I remember seeing it on Top of the Pops and being totally shocked. I think was one of them dressed like aloof, like the Gestapo or something as well.
That was the guy that I can't remember his name, who passed away a couple of weeks ago. From the suite. No, he had a policeman's helmet on, I believe,
that's it,
a little moustache, if I'm right.
Because
the camera kept sort of panning past him, and he looked like that. He had that kind of look of the dude from Sparks.
Yeah, that's it. I used to get Sparks. But I remember loving that song, and we were in North Belfast with my dad, because he's originally from the sort of North Belfast area, and we passed a record shop called Graham's, and they had Blockbuster in the window. And I said to my dad, oh, I love that song. He went, well, do you want it? And I went, yeah, you buy me it? And he went, my dad was trying to. And he says, well, tell you what, if I give you the money, you go and buy it. And I said, I don't want to go to the window. No, you come back. So my dad actually has a life lesson, give me the money. And I went in, stood in the queue, and then asked for Blockbuster by the suite and took
How
it
old
home.
Would you have been?
I would have been, so I think I was seven. I think it was 1972 something came out. So I was 6 or 7 years of age. And I still have that. I still have that record, and I absolutely love it. And I think that's why I like punk, because it's got that big crunchy power chord and it's got a stomp. So, you know, it's not a million miles away from the guitar sound on Nevermind the Bollocks.
Yep.
You know, and like stuff that I like later on, like the Ramones. And all, it's very simple and very chordy and very catchy. But I still think it's a brilliant song. And I remember I've only ever seen them once, and that was in the 90s, and I don't know what even lineup that was. It was at a sold out Olympia Theatre in Dublin, and I went there cynical, thinking, well, I'll probably leave and go to the pub after 3 songs. It was amazing night, great night. But no, I love that record, and it's I bought it in Graham's Records in Belfast.
How important did, well, you know, as you know, in your later years, you know, into your teens and upwards from there, how important did, you know, the record shops become for you?
Oh, they were everything. I mean, bearing in mind that this was Belfast, so like going into Belfast, if I wanted a record, there was a record shop in Ballyclare called Burt McCormick's, which would sell punk records that had charted. So, you know, if it was something like Banana Splits by the Dickies or Message in a Bottle, Police, you could get it because it was in the charts. But if you wanted something on Good Vibes Records or something by The Birthday Party or, you know, Alien Sex Fiend or something else, you had to go into Good Vibrations or Caroline Music in Belfast. Yeah. So we would always, from the age of 14, we would go in, once we had money, to those places. And that, you know, we'd go into Good Vibrations and Terry Hooley would be there. There'd be like Getty from The Outcasts. You know, we knew all these people from like the local media and from TV.
Yeah.
But we'd buy records there. And the other one was Caroline Music, a guy called Angus. And that was also what was great about them. I mean, Terry Hooley and Good Vibrations was cheeky and stuff like that, and he would give you good advice. And Angus was the main guy for us because Angus had such an amazing taste in music. So, like, you would go in and say, I remember the very first Husker Du record I bought. I read a review of it in Sounds magazine, and by this point, they'd released 3 albums. And Angus went, well, what are you after? And he gave you this breakdown of, you know, this is a kind of pop one, and this is a sprawling double masterpiece. And he'd tell you, so hey, but they were really, really important. And I mean, in therapy, it's hard to believe now, but when therapy started and we pressed up our own 7-inch single, Caroline Music actually had a section for local musicians where you would basically, we pressed up 1,000 copies of a single to sell at concerts. We brought one into Angus at Caroline Music in Belfast. And we were so proud because he went, okay, and he played it, and we were all there. We're going, oh God, what if he doesn't like it? And he played it, and then he put it up in the section, which was local music. And that was incredible for us. And, you know, that was like, it was where you would go and hang out as well. You know, I'm sure at the time we were a lot younger than that. I'm sure it was really annoying because myself and the other band members, whenever I was growing up. But yeah, so they were the two places, really great, Good Vibrations and Caroline Music. And you had to get, I think it was a trip, so like Ballyclare, where I was born, was I think 16 miles from Belfast. Yeah. So you had to get a bus, and then your parents. My dad was from Belfast, but he was saying, you know, this was during the Troubles. So like, you know, I wouldn't send my 20-year-old son on a bus into Belfast during the Troubles. Never mind a 14-year-old kid with his mate. Do you know what I mean? But you know, there we went, and we would go in, and we would find a place and. We would go to Good Vibes first, and then we'd go to Caroline Music because Caroline Music was near the bus stop.
Yeah.
And then we'd come home with a little bag, and then we'd all go to somebody's house, and we would all listen to what we bought together.
Oh, wonderful! I mean, it's really weird because I mean, just the journey that you've explained there to buy a record and to be in a record shop and, you know, and exposed to music like that. And I'm always really mindful in this podcast not to teeter into sounding like an old man going, well, it ain't how it used to be anymore. But there's definitely a value to them sort of journeys to buy a record, you know, because you could only afford one however often, you know, you would go into the local record shop and you would treasure that and you would play it, you know, A side, B side, study the cover. Well, I'm talking about myself here. I would. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And Whereas, you know, to go back to the first question I asked you about them constant distractions on streaming services and that, you know, I do think, you know, it's a double-edged sword, like, but yeah, I do think there's something about a journey to get a record and to then sort of cherish that, because you can't, you haven't got anything else, whereas now you've got everything, so I think it devalues it a little. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, exactly what you mean. I mean, I think the thing is, I mean, I get it from having a 20-year-old son that's at uni, that like he looks at four walls full of CDs and records and just goes, why? You know, because it's all the touch of a button for him. It's like, why would you want to bring this home and keep it here gathering dust? But, you know, that was a big thing. Like, I mean, I remember every record that I bought. And you know, that's why, you know, you would know this is a Porky Brown cut on the sleeve and who wrote the run-out groove and, you know,
yeah,
you know, we did know all that because we read the sleeves, and I mean, I do miss that, but at the same time, you know, I do listen to, you know, if I wanted to get the new album, but I don't know, Rainbow Grave or something like that, and it's available to listen to right now, sure. Or I have to get like a 45-minute train journey up to the past, I'm listening to it right now. I'll order it online later on, or I'll go and buy it whenever I'm next to town.
Yeah. All right, so after school, I presume there was some clubbing and going to nightclubs. So I want to know for track five, please, Andy, what the song was that soundtracked your years going to clubs.
It was Sweet Soul Music by Arthur Connolly. And that was simply for the fact that there was three clubs in Belfast at this point in time that we would go to. There was what they called the Metal Ring around the city centre. Because Belfast City Centre, which is, you know, which is where all the clubs were, you would either go to Belfast or Banbridge or Coleraine or something, but Belfast was nearest to me and my mates. And there was a club called The Plaza, a club called The Delta, and a club called Tatters. And what they would do was they were in the what they called the Metal Ring. So Belfast City Centre used to have like football-style turnstiles for you to get into, because obviously there were so many bombings, they didn't want sure. They didn't want the pubs in the city centre doing carnage. And so what somewhere like the Plaza did was they got an abandoned old building, three stories high, and they let the army would let you walk in with a carry out. So you would stop at an off license and buy 6, 7, 8 cans of beer. You would go up to the Plaza in Belfast. They would let you in. There was three stories. There'd be a cloakroom. At the cloakroom, you gave them your carry out bag and they would give you a ticket. So that was the bar, right? So you just went and showed your ticket and they gave you one of your cans. The reason we started going there was because at the time we were all into kind of the birthday party and Southern Death Cult and stuff like that, and The Cure, the pornography album, and all my mates were into all that, and they had a floor that would play that, and then they had a top floor that would play psychobilly, and then they had a bottom floor that would play Northern Soul and stuff like that. And you know, when you're young, especially not, we wouldn't just stay in the kind of Southern Death Cult birthday party goth floor. We would wander all over. And
that club sounds fucking amazing.
No, it was open to 5 or 6 in the morning. So what we would do, one of us would say, right, one of us is going to drive, the other three can drink. And you used to go there. No one ever really went to 11 o'clock at night. So you went to a friend's house, had a few drinks, went there, handed in your car out, stayed there to 5 in the morning. It was daylight when you came out and then you drove home. It was absolutely amazing. So there was a Delta and the Plaza that were quite similar, but everywhere seemed to have the same, because there were old buildings in Belfast abandoned, they were able to have 2 or 3 floors, and they always had like a sort of alternative rock gothy section, but they always had one playing. Tatters was where the DJ David Holmes used to play a lot there, and he would play a lot of stuff like, you know, Land of a Thousand Dances, Sweet Soul Music, James Brown. And at this point in time, we got a lot of mates that we knew from the area. We would meet there, so you know, we would bump into, we would go there with their kind of back home spiky hair, waiting for like a Hanging Garden by The Cure to come on so we could all get up and mope. But we'd meet people that, you know, we knew from the town that were there with like bomber jackets on and crew cuts, waiting for all the soul music to come on.
Yeah.
And that was one song that they played everywhere. And it was like, and it was that kind of thing, you know, where we would all dance to it, you know. So we're that cool. And then we'd all be up, you know, like sort of like this Nick Cave hair in the middle. Chuckling.
I mean, that could arguably be one of the greatest intros ever as well. What a start, Arthur Connolly. Like, brilliant start to a record. For track 6, let's stay in Belfast. And a favourite track from an artist from your home county, please, Andy.
Abbey Rudy and Big Time. And that was Rudy, where everyone talked about them. So, I mean, at the time when we were kids, you know, Belfast did such, I mean, we cannot underestimate the importance of punk in Northern Ireland, because up, you know, whenever I, before punk came along, if I ever went into Belfast, you know, there were things like, don't wear blue if you're going to this area, don't wear green if you're going to that area, you know, keep your mouth shut about where you're from if you walk around. You had to be really careful. And punk was one of the things where no one gave a toss where you came from or what your religious background was. And it was very, very anti-sectarian and quite unifying. So, you know, I would go and see bands like Susie and the Banshees, the UK Subs, whatever, up in Belfast. And no one was fighting. Everyone looked, you know, everyone looked punk and everyone looked, well, I remember the first time my dad dropped me off at Susie and the Banshees concert. He was like, well, I'm not dropping him there. Look at the state of them ones. But they were really friendly. It was that kind of, the people that were going to give you a kick in were the people, you know, that looked like football casuals.
Yeah.
But he sort of dropped all those gigs. And the one band that everyone talked about was a band. And they did a song called Big Time, and far bigger than Stiff Little Fingers and then the Undertones, because they wrote amazing songs. The front man was kind of like Mark Bolan meets Richie Manic meets Keith Richards. You know, they were really poppy. Imagine like, whenever I first heard Ash, for example, I thought that reminds me of Rudy. It was like very, very Northern Irish, but at the same time, incredibly catchy. And they had some amazing, you know, again, anytime you went to like see a punk band, the DJ between the acts, he would play, you know, Dead Kennedys and The Damned, but he would always play Rudy songs as well. So everybody knew them. And most of the punks in Belfast, they would have Rudy painted somewhere in their biker jacket. But the thing, the most important thing for us was that, you know, if you went to a gig, you would see members of Rudy at the bar. So again, it's taken it further away from that Top of the Pops thing with the glam rock. It humanized it and made it approachable for us. Yeah. And, you know, if you'd have gone up and spoke to any members of Rudy or any of those bands, you had Catherine like that, they would have talked to you because they were in the crowd too.
Yeah.
And that was, I mean, the song Big Time, I don't know what it is. It's that, it's like a thing from the north of Ireland for me. It's very much punk in Northern Ireland, and Big Time, You Ain't No Friend of Mine. And only a Northern Irish band could write that sentiment to probably the most catchiest tune, one of the catchiest tunes from 1978. And they always like, you know, that I'd made an art at school, you know, as a project. I made a Rudy t-shirt. I used to Rudy on the bottom of my biker jacket. And they were legendary. But that was the thing for me. There was something, I suppose, that was pure about them. There was no, the Undertones were from Derry and they had Fergal Sharkey and Sire Records wanted them. And Stiff Little Fingers were all really well known in the area because they'd all been in various bands. They're all incredibly good musicians. But Rudy were just this, there was a purity to them that I really liked.
I'd not heard of them until you sent your list over, and I went and done a bit of prep and had a listen on that, and it does sound very much. I was curious to know when you said 1978, then what year that was, like, because it does just sound like pure Irish punk rock, like, and it's so melodic as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they had a lot of bad luck. You know, they were on Paul Weller. Paul Weller had a label called Jamming that he signed them to for a little while. I mean, the Jam
took
them on tour, yeah. The Jam took Rudy on tour. And, you know, by all accounts, it was really good success. The fans liked them all, but they had so much bad luck and members left. And they lived in London for a while and then they came home and nothing really happened. But if you don't know if you've ever seen it, it's a really good film called Good Vibrations, which is the story of that scene. That's really good for anyone that doesn't know about Rudy or the Outcasts or the Good Vibrations label. Go and see that film or rent it.
So, was the band in that's in the film? That's Rudy.
Rudy's in that.
Right.
The band obviously don't play themselves, but it's the two main.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but the two main bands are Rudy and the Outcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Right. You can play DJ now. And then it's the last song, and it's a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
Yeah, well, this is all about my formative years, so it's very much heavy. It's very much from the punk era, but Therapy's been around a long time, and the things that influenced us were things like Big Black and Sonic Youth and Mudhoney and Public Enemy and Fugazi. So things that, you know, were a lot more update it on the punk sound than what records I've just talked about. But you know, we've always liked as a band electronic music, and we've always liked things like whether it's Belgian new beat, really early techno rave, or you know, stuff like that. But what happened to me was it was at a period in my life where I was getting very disillusioned with music, and at a period of illness. It was about 2007, and I read a review in, I think, The Guardian by the journalist Kitty Empire of the first Burial album, and I went out and got it, and it was absolutely amazing, and I was completely obsessed with it. It's just, it was like another world, and it reminded me of being a kid again, where I could put my headphones on and listen to music from start to finish. And a bit like earlier on, we talked about that journey of the bus. Yeah. One thing I think that a lot of kids miss out on a lot is the journey of an album.
Yeah.
Where you, like London Calling, where you don't just put on London Calling and then skip through tracks. You listen to the whole double album, Exile on Main Street, you know, Joy Division, Unknown Pleasures. And I think with Burial, the first and second Burial, the second record, Untrue, for me was just, I could escape with that record. You know, at the time I was ill, and all I would do would be put the headphones on and go for a walk. But it reminded me of Joy Division. It reminded me of Black Sabbath. And it reminded me of all the best kind of early electronic records that I like, Guy Called Gerald and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Listen to.
It's stark. It's quite cold. It's like, it's I can definitely hear what you're saying in regards to Guy Called Gerald and Joy Division and things like that. It's headphone music as well. That album, like, Untrue, that's for the headphones. It's incredible record.
Yeah. And it's brilliant. Yeah.
And so you spoke there about records being listened to in their entirety as you know, as a journey. So when you write now and there's new therapy albums, and we talk about how earlier music can be, you know, quite, I won't use the word disposable, but there's constant distractions, you know, where people just go on iTunes and cherry pick tunes. Do you still write an album as a body of work to be listened to as an album?
We try to, and it doesn't always work. I mean, after I discovered Burial, we did two albums called Crooked Timber and A Brief Crack of Light that were really influenced by that and a lot of the music on Hyperdub. And they are designed to be listened to as a whole because, you know, there's not really any standout singles on those records, and they're very much, a lot of therapy fans find them quite difficult. But a lot of people that got it went, oh God, I listened to that record the way through. But I suppose what we do look for is a uniformity, because part of our eclecticism that we've developed ever since we were kids and we started the band sometimes is our worst enemy. Because, you know, we're a rock band. We use bass, guitar, drums, vocals, you know, that we don't use any electronics in the sound or anything. But we take elements from all different music, and sometimes if we discover, say, a dub track, we'll try and emulate it and it will backfire. It won't sit nicely with the other songs. So it is something that we do try and do. We do, I mean, that's why we leave tracks off albums and stuff like that, because they maybe don't sit. The last album we did, Cleave, there were three or four tracks we didn't put on that because, you know, it was meant to be a sort of high-energy rock album, and we left off the tracks that maybe upset the pattern of that a little bit. But I find that incredibly difficult to do. That's always one of the, I mean, once we, well, say we record, I don't know, 14 songs for a 10-track album, it's trying to get the sequence right. Back to what you were saying earlier on about the intro of a track, I mean, the opening track on the album is really, really important anyway, because it's got to be someone that makes you want to go, oh, hello, you know, I'm going to sit this. Yeah. And you cannot, often the easy thing to do is pick the one that you think everyone's going to like.
Yeah.
That's not always the case. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so when lockdown lifts and we get back to whatever sort of routine and normality, whatever normality is going to present itself, what's lying in the future for Andy and therapy?
Well, we had we already had an incredible amount of work that was meant to sell it to this year, 2020, our 2020 is our 30th anniversary. So we were going to do two 30th anniversary tours to go on. We did a Greatest Hits Live at Abbey Road album as well, which had just come out and it got into the top 40. So we thought, oh, this is looking really great. And then the whole thing happened. But, you know, things are more important than that at the moment. So what we have done is basically transported all that to next year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll be doing two European tours, lots of festivals. next year. What we are doing this year is we are writing new material for our next album, which we will record when we get a chance. But the idea is to have like 14, 15 songs written. There's a book coming out. Simon Young, that used to be the editor of Kerrang, has written the official biography called So Much for the 30-Year Plan. And that comes out on Jawbone Press in September. As far as I know, we've talked to our agent and our management. We won't be setting foot on a stage until March, April. You know, there was talk of maybe going back in December. So the plan will be, if we're allowed to go into the recording studios in December, that's when we'll record a new album.
Yeah.
But then all of next year, to a certain extent, we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary in the 31st year, if that makes sense.
And so if people want to find out and keep up to speed on everything that's coming up, where's the best place to go to?
www.therapy?co.uk, and then that's got the links to the Instagram and everything else as well, and Twitter.
Wonderful. And if it's all right with you, when we put this out, we'll tag you in all the posts on the socials and stuff.
No, please. And see, lovely. Let us know everything that we can do and we'll put it up, yeah.
Oh, amazing. Andy, thank you so much for your time today, mate. It's been an absolute joy.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for helping me.
Oh, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure. All right, thanks, mate. There you go. I told you at the beginning that was an amazing conversation. And it was such a shame right at the very end when we were saying goodbye that there was actually a clap of thunder and it made my computer sort of Wi-Fi stagger and so there was that kind of awkward glitch at the end. But but it was an absolute pleasure to get to sit and chat to Andy, and what an interesting episode that was. Okay, again, we're back next week. So in the meantime, as mentioned at the beginning, go and have a rummage in the archives of the previous episodes and see who tickles your fancy over there. And if you want more than that, as I said as well at the beginning, there is a Patreon page which has standalone episodes. Find out about everything at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. See you next week. Thanks again for listening. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing, www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.